Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine and Lynn are joined by Dr. Anise Chagpar. Dr. Chagpar is the director of the Yale Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by talking a little bit about your interest in breast cancer and how you actually got into the field of breast cancer.
Well, I think, I always wanted to be a doctor and very rapidly became interested in surgery. And within the field of surgery, breast cancer is unique. It is a fascinating area that really involves a myriad of disciplines all working together. And for me, that was something that was very compelling. I loved everything about breast cancer. I loved the patients. I loved the fact that we could really make a difference for these women. I loved the fact that we worked in a team. And I loved the fact that breast cancer research was moving at such a wild pace that every time you turned around, something new was around the corner.
Anise, we were talking a little bit before the show about your background and some of the things that you've done in terms of your education and developing specialized expertise. Review some of that with us.
Yeah. So I'm Canadian. I was born and raised in Toronto. I did my undergraduate degree in biochemistry at the University of Alberta, followed by my MD there. And then I went to the University of Saskatchewan and did my general surgery residency and took some time to do a master's of surgery where I really looked at microsatellite instability in breast cancer. So really looking at molecular biology and how that affects prognosis for breast cancer patients. And then I was fortunate to go to MD Anderson and be their inaugural breast fellow and really learn about multidisciplinary breast cancer care. And that was fabulous. Then I went to the University of Louisville, where I've been for the last 7 years or so, and did a stint at Harvard, doing a Master's of Public Health in Clinical Effectiveness there. Came back to Louisville, did a Master's of Arts in Bioethics and Medical Humanities. So I've really had a very broad educational background, but it's been a lot of fun and I think has really complemented my clinical background.
So you have a very unusual background for a breast cancer surgeon. It sounds to me like your research is probably multidisciplinary across all of these different areas.
Yeah, that's true. So I really enjoy, as we talked about in the beginning, I really enjoy collaborating across disciplines and doing things that that bring together multiple disciplines of diverse expertise, because I think that that really allows you to gain innovative insights into complex questions.
Tell us about the problem of breast cancer in the United States today. We all know that we've heard this number, 1 in 9 women, and we've also seen that there's been a lot of progress in breast cancer. Tell us about the magnitude of the problem.
So every year, approximately 200,000 women in the United States are diagnosed with breast cancer. It's the number one malignancy affecting women in this country, and in fact, it's a global problem. But the nice thing about breast cancer is that we really have made strides. If you look at the incidence of breast cancer over the last 5 years, it actually has decreased to some extent because we've gained an understanding about the relationship between hormone replacement therapy and the incidence of breast cancer, which has affected women's behavior. But unfortunately, part of that reduction in incidence was due to a reduction in mammography rates. And we elucidated some of that by looking at some national databases that found that this was a trend. But so really, breast cancer continues to be an issue, but we're making huge strides in terms of early detection, better treatments, and better prognosis for our patients.
Could you share with us what are certain types of women at higher risk for breast cancer, younger women, older women, different types of race? What are some of the factors that might be concerning for increased risk.
Yeah. So the two risks, the two main risks of developing breast cancer are being a woman and getting older. So while we often talk about breast cancer as a women's only disease, you have to remember that 1% of all breast cancers do occur in men. So being a woman is a big factor. Also getting older is a big factor. So the median age or the average age for women developing breast cancer in this country is 67. That's not to say that young women don't develop breast cancer. They do. And that's important to realize because when young women develop breast cancer, it's often very aggressive and something that we really need to pay close attention to. But all of the other factors, so we talked a little bit about hormone replacement therapy, and we know that there's a huge relationship between both endogenous hormones, the hormones that your body makes, and exogenous hormones, hormones that you take, that increases your risk of breast cancer. There are certain genetic populations that have an increased risk of breast cancer. So we often think about BRCA1 and 2 gene mutation carriers, but there are a variety of genetic syndromes, P53 mutations, P10 mutations, that can all increase your risk of developing breast cancer. And then there are benign breast disease problems that can also increase your risk. So things like atypia, things like lobular carcinoma in situ increase your risk of developing breast cancer. So there's a myriad of risk factors that we're cognizant of.
Well, now that we're aware of many of these new risk factors, have we really changed our recommendations about screening and at what age a woman starts to get mammograms?
So that's an interesting point. And as you know, over the last year or so, the United States Preventative Services Task Force came out with new recommendations, and that led to a flurry of media and recommendations. Truth be told, you know, across academic institutions and across professional societies, the vast majority of us still recommend for average risk women starting having mammography at age 40 and having annual mammograms. Now, the USPSTF task force did look at a number of epidemiologic studies and did have a number of models that really kind of tried to tease out the benefit of mammography starting at age 40 versus at age 50 to tease out whether we should be doing this annually or every 2 years and when we should stop. But across the board, currently, the recommendations stand at annually starting at age 40.
Speaking technically about mammography, that's a test, screening test, that's been around for a pretty long time. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit, tell our listeners how that technology has changed, evolved, hopefully improved over the years.
Yeah. So the one thing I think to remember is, although it's an old technology, it's been around for a long, long time, it still is one of the very best technologies we have for detecting breast cancer. So while, you know, you often hear buzz about, you know, thermography and infrared imaging, which sounds very hot and cool and sexy, mammography still does a better job of picking up early breast cancers than many of these other techniques. But mammography itself has come a long way. So in years past, we had what was called analog mammography or conventional screen film mammography, which has really now transitioned more to the digital age. And what this does is it really doesn't pick up more breast cancers necessarily, but it really reduces the callback. So it's a lot like taking a picture with a regular camera versus with a digital camera. And you know how with a digital camera, you can put it on your computer screen and you can adjust the brightness and you can adjust the contrast. Sometimes you can see things that you didn't see otherwise. Whereas with a screen film mammogram, just like with a film picture, you get what you get. And so it really has helped to reduce the callback rate. There's also been implementation of new technology in the form of computer-aided detection, which helps us to find things that we might not have otherwise seen as well. But the best thing that goes with a good quality digital mammogram is a high-quality radiologist. You just can't beat that.
In terms of access for women, some of these new technologies that you just talked about, are they commonly available at most medical centers?
No. And you know what? I think that that's probably a good thing, because a lot of these have not had the evidence that we need to really embrace them. There are newer technologies, however, that are available at most medical centers that really do serve as a nice adjunct to mammography. So ultrasound, MRI, these are things that really are things that your radiologist may recommend as complementary to a standard mammogram.
Once it's sort of worked out what age perhaps someone should begin screening with mammography, that's, I think, pretty well worked out. But share with us some of your thoughts about self-examination. Is that something that women should be thinking about or doing or not doing, or how regularly, if you think it's a good idea?
Yeah. So that's another area that's had a lot of controversy, as you know. There are some who say, you know, we should be doing monthly self-breast exams. Others say, well, you know, that's really difficult because many women have lumpy, bumpy breast tissue, fibrocystic change. And so some worry about increasing anxiety in women. You know, they're feeling their breasts every month and they feel a lump and, oh my gosh, could this be cancer? And are we really doing these women a favor by advocating monthly self-breast exam? So the recommendations have gone back and forth on this, and I think the standard really is that we recommend monthly self-breast exams if you're comfortable with that, and really, if you feel anything abnormal, you should talk to your doctor. But the purpose of self-breast exam is really that you get comfortable with understanding your own body and what your breasts feel like.
Can you talk a little bit about some of these genetic syndromes that you mentioned? I think a lot of people are now familiar with the genetics and how that's really predictive of outcome and predictive of other cancers that patients are going to develop, and family syndromes, et cetera. And I think there are a lot of people out there that are scared off by genetics. So can you talk a little bit about the role of genetics in breast cancer and in screening?
Yeah. So the first thing that I'll say right off the bat is that this really is a conversation. It is not a test. And so there has been, in recent years, a lot of direct-to-consumer marketing of genetic testing, which I think is a really bad idea. Because as we talked about, there's more than just one syndrome. There's more than just one test. And how you interpret those results, which can be all over the map, it's not a black and white answer, is really a complex thing. And so the first thing that I'll say is that if you're concerned about your genetics, you're concerned about your family history, and you want to know more about that, you should seek out a genetic counselor, because that's a service that you really should avail yourself of in terms of learning about genetics. In terms of genetic syndromes, as I said, you know, they're really all over the map. We think about BRCA 1 and 2, as the only breast and ovarian cancer syndromes, but there are many. There are syndromes that are associated with P10 mutations or P53 mutations, and these have different characteristics in terms of the family pedigree, in terms of what cancers can run in families. And so what I would tell you is that's a conversation you need to have with your physician and get a referral to a genetic counselor to really delve more into that.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about the treatment of breast cancer with Dr. Anise Chagpar.
It's estimated that nearly 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, and over 2,000 new cases will be diagnosed in Connecticut alone. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses three-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today we're joined by Dr. Anise Chagpar, and we are discussing treatment for breast cancer. Dr. Chagpar, give us your thoughts on how the treatment for breast cancer has really changed over the last even 5 years, especially in surgery, for example, since you're our surgeon. Yeah. Give us your thoughts on that.
So the wonderful thing about breast cancer treatment in general and surgery in particular is that it's such a rapidly evolving field, and we've made tremendous advances. So I'm going to actually, Lynn, take us back, 30 years ago when women didn't have many choices. You know, you would go to your doctor, often with a locally advanced breast cancer, and there was only one choice. It was called a radical mastectomy. The breast, the muscles, the lymph nodes, everything was removed. It was a very disfiguring procedure, but it did control the disease. And since that time, we've had huge clinical trials that have demonstrated that you don't need to do such radical surgery. That, in fact, a radical mastectomy has equal survival to a simple mastectomy, where you can leave the muscles there, you can leave the lymph nodes there, and survival is exactly the same. And then we discovered that we didn't even need to do a mastectomy. You could simply remove the cancer, and the survival was exactly the same. Now, local regional recurrence, or the chances of getting cancer back in the breast, was higher if you removed just the cancer. But if you added radiation, then the local recurrence rates were also the same. So survival was the same, local recurrence rates were the same. And so now women have choices of, do I want a mastectomy? Do I want a lumpectomy or a partial mastectomy where just the cancer will be removed and radiation? And then even within those categories, there are more choices. So for example, with patients who have a mastectomy, you don't have to go flat anymore. Now we have options of skin-sparing mastectomy, sometimes nipple-sparing mastectomy, and immediate reconstruction. And that reconstruction can be done in many different ways. You can have autologous tissue, where you take tissue from your own body, often from places where you have too much tissue to places where you would like to have a little less. So moving tissue from your belly, giving you a tummy tuck, type procedure, or from your back, or using implants of any size that you wanted to have to reconstruct the breast and give you a cosmetic outcome that that you're happy with while also removing the cancer. For people who want to have a partial mastectomy or a lumpectomy, now we have ways of doing that that actually improves cosmetic outcomes. So this whole concept of oncoplastic surgery, where we combine plastic surgery type techniques with oncologic procedures where we can remove a cancer and provide an optimal cosmetic outcome at the same time, is really moving the field forward.
How do we evaluate the lymph nodes if we do the smaller operation with the lumpectomy?
Yeah.
Talk to our listeners, how do we evaluate the lymph nodes? Do we need to do a big operation? Can we do a smaller one to evaluate that part of the situation?
Yeah. So this whole mastectomy, lumpectomy thing is just about how do we take care of the cancer that's in the breast. The lymph nodes is an entirely separate issue, and we can actually address the lymph nodes in a minimally invasive way, whether we do a mastectomy or we do a lumpectomy. So it was actually about in 1994 to 1996 that Armando Giuliano came up with this idea that we could use sentinel lymph node biopsy to evaluate the lymph nodes. And this is a technique where we can inject a radioactive tracer and or a blue dye into the breast. Now, that dye will follow a pathway much the same as cancer cells would take in the breast to the lymph nodes. So we can accurately identify which lymph nodes are most likely to harbor cancer, because the dye took the same path that the cancer would have taken to those first lymph nodes. And we can take out those first lymph nodes, give that to our pathologist right in the operating room, and find out if those lymph nodes have cancer or not. If the lymph nodes don't have cancer, we don't need to take out the remaining lymph nodes. We don't need to take out all of the lymph nodes under the arm, giving us all kinds of complications like lymphedema and so on, because we know that that doesn't improve survival. But if the cancer is in those lymph nodes, well, then we can go on and take out the remaining lymph nodes because we know that there's a chance that there may be other lymph nodes that are involved.
So is the use of this sentinel node technology commonplace now in breast cancer surgery and management?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you've done a lot of work, I understand, a lot of kind of national database work looking at the use of sentinel node biopsies, looking at the incidence of chest wall recurrences in women. Could you talk a little bit about that whole concept of research, looking at these national databases and how that's really helped us to move forward in the treatment of breast cancer?
Yeah. So with regards to sentinel node biopsy, I came from Louisville, Kentucky, which houses the world's largest database of sentinel node biopsy in women with breast cancer. And we had done a national, in fact, international study looking at women early on in the genesis of sentinel lymph node biopsy for breast cancer to really evaluate this technique. And that laid the foundation, I think, for a lot of us to really make sentinel node biopsy commonplace. But a lot of my work now has been in looking at women who have a positive sentinel node. So Lynn, you and I were talking a little bit about, you know, if a woman has a sentinel node that has cancer, we take out all of the remaining lymph nodes. But only a proportion of those women will have non-sentinel node metastases. So in other words, will have cancer in those remaining lymph nodes. Well, if they didn't have any cancer in the remaining lymph nodes, and we could know who had cancer in the remaining lymph nodes and who didn't, then we could potentially spare those who didn't the dissection. And so how do you evaluate that, and how do you predict that? Because that's really how we can start to tailor therapy for individual women. And so I've done a lot of work trying to find clinical prediction models that can accurately tell us who will need that completion dissection and who won't. And I'm currently working on building in molecular models into that concept to try to refine those models a little bit better.
When you talk about molecular markers, could you tell our listeners exactly what that is?
So we've looked at this in a variety of different ways. So molecular markers are essentially anything that you can look at that's in the tissue that's a small molecule or a biomarker that can give you some information. So one of the things that I was doing and have an NIH grant to do is to look at mammoglobin and CK19. These are markers that are on epithelial breast cancer cells that we can find in lymph nodes. So when we take out that sentinel lymph node, we can look for these markers, and we actually have an assay that will give us quantitative data. So it'll tell us how many breast cancer cells with these markers are in this lymph node. So you can imagine that if you have lots of cells that have these markers, so lots of breast cancer cells in these sentinel lymph nodes, that there's a higher likelihood that the non-sentinel lymph nodes will be involved. Whereas if you have very few, then there's less of a likelihood. So building in that kind of modeling. Just a couple of days ago, I was talking to some of the researchers here at Yale about building in circulating tumor cell markers into that whole concept. And so it's really trying to gather as much information as we can from the primary tumor and as much information as we can from the sentinel lymph node that we can get at the time of that decision point of whether or not we need to complete that axillary dissection that's going to help us to tailor that therapy.
Now, we have a variety of treatments, some of them you've already mentioned, for breast cancer surgery, radiation, hormonal therapy, chemotherapy. Talk to us about the importance of multidisciplinary management of a breast cancer patient and what that means, and how do you coordinate all of these various treatments for any given patient? Sounds very complicated.
It is very complicated, but that's what makes it fun. So one of the things that really enticed me into the whole field of breast cancer was this multidisciplinary approach. And the fact is that you need that team. You need a breast cancer surgeon and a radiation oncologist and a medical oncologist and an imager and a pathologist and a plastic surgeon and a geneticist and a psychologist and a social worker and a team of nurses all working together as one concerted team for the patient. Because the truth of the matter is that every decision that's made has an influence on every other discipline. So, for example, if you're a patient who's having surgery, you may want to have reconstruction, so you need a plastic surgeon. Well, the decision of whether or not you're going to need radiation may influence the plastic surgery treatment. And when the radiation occurs will be influenced by whether or not you need chemotherapy. And that is going to be influenced by what the pathology looks like. And the pathology has to be coordinated with the imaging to make sure that that makes sense. And then we have to treat the patient as a whole patient, because this doesn't occur in a vacuum. So there's the whole psychosocial part that also plays in. And so it really is this coordinated, multidisciplinary team that gets together, and here at Yale, like in other centers, really focuses on the patient. How do we organize this care? How do we put it all together? We all sit down every week at a conference and discuss every patient. How can we do the best thing for this patient? We have nurse coordinators that take patients through every step of the process so that everything is really a well-oiled machine. And it really is spectacular when you come out and you say to yourself, my gosh, this was a very complicated thing, but boy, do I feel really well taken care of by this team of experts, all of whom took care of me.
It sounds to me like there's obviously a lot of work that goes into the initial treatment decisions. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of interdisciplinary approaches that are involved in that initial step. What happens to women as they move through their treatment? So, you know, after the first year, the second year, the fifth year, ongoing hormonal therapy, ongoing monitoring. Now, how does the multimodality approach really impact the long-term management of breast cancer?
Right. So you're exactly right. There's a lot of activity in that initial period. And as time goes on, you really do move into this more chronic survivorship mode, which is fabulous because a lot of people are now beginning to see breast cancer as a chronic disease, just because we do have long-term survivors, which is fabulous for a cancer. And so, you know, one of the things that we have at Yale, which I think is really unique, is a survivorship program where patients are seen by a whole team of people who are really dedicated to that whole aspect. What is the nutrition like? What about physical therapy? What about psychosocial needs? And then the medical aspect carries on as well. So that's a really important aspect as you transition your care, but it really should be a very seamless transition.
Well, that would actually segue into something that I'd really like to spend some time on, which is one of your interests recently has been to get involved with this whole concept of mindfulness and impact of the mood and the immune system and the kind of whole person on outcome in breast cancer.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when I came from Louisville, as we kind of talked about before the show, I really enjoyed having cross-disciplinary research interests. And one of those was to team up with psychologists and immunologists to look at stress and its influence on breast cancer patients, both from a global perspective, but also from a biochemical, how does this affect your immune system standpoint. And we've really transitioned that into the whole mindfulness concept. And so it's interesting. I just came back from a meeting with Judd Brewer, who is a mindfulness expert here at Yale, who is going to help us in really looking at mindfulness and outcomes in breast cancer patients and how that really does affect stress, how that affects the immune system, and how that affects clinical outcomes. It's incredibly exciting work that I think has real clinical impact.
Dr. Anise Chagpar is the director of the Yale Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.